From the KUNV studios in Las Vegas, you're listening to Our Metropolis, a weekly interview program with people who are changing the face of Las Vegas. And now, here is your host.
This is John Katzlamidis. I am the host of Our Metropolis, and also the author of the Katz Report multimedia blog, which appears on the Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly websites, and also in the Las Vegas Sun print edition on Thursdays, Tuesdays, and Saturdays. Our guest this week is an assistant professor of women's studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where we are right now. She is an expert in sexuality studies who has lived in Sin City for 3 years and is also a new columnist, as it turns out, for Las Vegas Weekly. Her first column, which centers on the Deseret Alliance Conference, which is the only conference of its type in North America, is in the current issue, and that's what she's talking about. And welcome to the show, Lynn Camella.
Hi, thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
No problem. I expect that. Let's talk a little bit about, there's so much ground to cover with you. You arrived in Las Vegas 3 years ago.
Yes, I did.
And what was your perception of the city at that time?
Well, actually, my perception of the city, I had a really kind of great experience landing in Vegas. And, you know, I was a little bit skeptical, a little bit apprehensive initially mm-hmm. about moving to Las Vegas because it's such a different kind of place. And right. what I knew of Vegas, like many people, was what I had seen on TV and film. Mm-hmm. So it really took kind of being in Vegas, living downtown, meeting a lot of great downtowners to really get a sense of all of the things that made up Vegas that kind of were off the strip. You know, my reaction, I found a home in Vegas, and, mm-hmm. and you know, I love Vegas. And Vegas is a really, really interesting place, but also highly contradictory in lots of ways,
Where did you come from? Fascinating. Where did you come from before you were directly?
Directly from Bloomington, Indiana. Right. I was teaching in the gender studies department in mm-hmm. At Indiana University for 2 years before I got the job offer at UNLV. So I was coming from a dramatically different
setting. It's been said that Las Vegas is the opposite of everywhere, and it's certainly true in this instance. I expect from Bloomington, Indiana, which is it's a hometown of John Mellencamp, I believe.
Yes, he still lives there.
Yeah,
actually.
He's from there. Little pink houses. So you come out to Las Vegas, and I feel like the people around you were kind of excited about the prospects of you with your background coming to Las Vegas in this position. In studying what you've studied and how you've been educated, and it seems like a target-rich environment. It's going to be a big playground for you, mm-hmm. and has that been the case?
Yeah, it has been the case. I mean, I think you're exactly right. I was really warmly received when I stepped onto campus, and a large part of that is that there's a really vibrant community of feminist scholars at UNLV, and also a number of people who already do work on sexuality. So mm-hmm. Barb Brent's in the sociology department, Kate Hausbeck, they've studied the legal brothel systems in Nevada. So I really felt like it was a great opportunity to be part of a kind of growing culture of researchers doing work on various aspects of sexuality and culture. And of course, they were really warmly welcoming and excited to have, you know, another colleague in the mix. And so that's been really great.
And how is the sexual identity of Las Vegas, from your perspective, do we deserve to be called Sin City? We're known for so much adult entertainment, mm-hmm. primarily. That's how we've mm-hmm. gotten that title that was bestowed upon us by people who visit here, I think, mm-hmm. more than people who actually live here. Has that been your experience, that we are that? And if so, how do we live up to that title?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question, because that moniker, Sin City, is definitely how Las Vegas really sees itself and promotes itself. It's mm-hmm. how a lot of tourists clearly think of Las Vegas. I mean, if I've been surprised by anything in the 3 years that I've been in Las Vegas, it is that extent to which Vegas, for all intents and purposes, is a rather sexually conservative place.
Really? How so?
And, you know, people might be surprised to kind of hear that, but I also think there are people who might be shaking their heads. So what I mean by that is, on the one hand, Vegas is this hyper-sexualized place. I mean, you can't turn around in Las Vegas without seeing kind of a sexy billboard or a really busty cocktail waitress.
Mm-hmm. The hot
Industrial Drive, and it's strip club after strip club. Mm-hmm. So we have all of this kind of sexual iconography that's really, really present. Yet at the same time, there's very little kind of public discussion or discourse about sexuality or the sexualized economy. So it's here, it's everywhere, yet it's kind of underground at the same time. But also, if you look closely at the kinds of sexual representations or images that do exist in Las Vegas, it's fairly predictable. It's fairly mainstream. Like, there's nothing that's really super duper edgy about it. So it's a kind of, it's this kind of contradictory space. Like, there's this hyper-sexualized culture and sex is everywhere, yet at the same time, it's somewhat mainstream. It's the kind of sexuality, I would argue, that is really easily consumed by tourists who can go home and brag about the sexy time they had in Las Vegas without being too scandalized.
They land and then they ask, you know, you come into town for whatever reason. Let's say you're in a bachelor party and you ask the cabbie, you know, take me to a strip club. And they take you to a strip club and you spend, you know, a couple days in Las Vegas running around. And in your entertainment, when this is true of women too, they do something sort of naughty. And then you leave.
But it's a predictable naughty too, and it's not going to scandalize anybody too much. You know,
like you're talking about the dance clubs in town, that kind of thing. That's not unique to anywhere else in the United States, is what you're saying. What about places like the Green Door? What about the clubs in town that are swingers clubs that are open sexually that you can enter?
I think that those are definitely a little bit more unique. You're going to have a harder time finding those places in Bloomington, Indiana, than you would strip clubs. And and so those are interesting places, but they're also places that, you know, a lot of people might be really trepidatious or uncomfortable about exploring. And I went to the Red Rooster kind of on an ethnographic foray just to check it out. And it was really
ethnographic
interesting.
Foray.
It was last fall. And I went by myself, which was quite interesting.
Interesting.
It was just, you know, curiosity. People had mentioned this. Here I am in Vegas. I study sexuality. There are these places that aren't kind of, you know, the more predictable strip clubs. I thought, okay, I've been in Vegas for 2 years now. I've never gone to either the Green Door or the Red Rooster.
This is after 2 years you'd lived here and you hadn't entered into either one of these places.
Yeah, so I went last fall because I just thought, you know, I'm a sexuality scholar and I live in Vegas and it's worth checking some of these things out. So I steeled myself and I went there alone. And it was a very interesting experience in positive ways. I mean, I actually was sharing this story with a friend last week. And, I have to say that if anyone ever needs like to have kind of their ego boosted, particularly a female, just go to the Red Rooster because get so much attention. But the thing that's really great.
See, that doesn't speak to me to be conservative at all. That's pretty wide open. And for those who are uninitiated, the Red Rooster and Green Door are open sex sort of more or less free-for-all clubs where you can
I think they build themselves as swingers clubs.
Swingers
I think
clubs
that's
in the traditional sense.
Themselves.
Yeah. Okay. Just so we establish
And so
that.
I haven't been
Why didn't you go with somebody?
I had talked about going with a friend and he was working and couldn't go and I just figured that I was going to go on, you know, by myself. But the thing is, I mean, I should say that, I mean, it was really just kind of checking it out. And, you know, from a kind of social, cultural, academic, you know, interest. And one of the things that is kind of worth appreciating about a place like the Red Rooster is, you know, there are certain boundaries and there's certain rules, and it is an environment where no means no. If someone approaches mm-hmm. you and, you know, is, you know, interested, if you want to, you know, anything from dancing or something more, all you have to do is say no, and they turn away and no one's feelings are hurt. And I mean, I said no a lot that night. No, I'm not interested. No, thank you. That's nice. No, I'm not interested. But there are these, you know, and if someone doesn't respect those boundaries, they're kind of escorted off the premise. Now, that's really different than if you were to maybe go to a bar and club or a club mm-hmm. and you have someone who's, you know, pretty, you know, interested in picking somebody up or hitting on someone. They might not be so inclined to respect no. They might keep trying. And so, you know, places like Red Rooster, it's a whole cultural scene, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's rules, there's ways of doing things. You need to abide by those rules. But I think the thing that interests me, you know, about studying kind of sexuality and sexual culture is, you know, being able to ask questions about a place like the Red Rooster, who many people, you know, might be ready to dismiss or might be ready to think of, oh, those are just losers who go there, or they're just perverts who go there, or, mm-hmm.
Can you get a read on that after one visit?
No.
Can you get a read on that?
I mean, if I was doing something more in-depth on swinger clubs, it would be multiple repeated mm-hmm. visits. I wouldn't necessarily have to be a participant, but I would have to kind of study the cultural scene. I would have to interview people and talk to people.
Right.
And I didn't go there as, you know, someone who was interested in starting a project on swinger clubs, although there are people that do that kind of research. I was mostly interested in, this exists in Vegas. Mm-hmm. You know, I studied different aspects of sexual culture in the adult industry,
right.
This would be worth at least seeing what it's like.
The same way you'd go to a dance club or, mm-hmm. you know, you go to a place like wherever, Olympic Garden or Palomino mm-hmm. or wherever, for that purpose, mm-hmm. right? And in an entirely different context, the nightclub industry in this city is built on the hookup. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's built, I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's what it's not. I hate to say this, but it's not the groovy architecture, the DJs, or anything else. I think at the end of it, it is about people being able to interact with the opposite sex or whoever they mm-hmm. want to in a sexual way.
Mm-hmm.
And have you looked into that?
No,
knifed into that industry?
No,
yet?
I haven't. Spent a lot of time in Vegas's nightclubs. You know, I won't reveal my age, but I feel mm-hmm. a little bit too old. I mean, that's where my students would go, you mm-hmm. know, and also, you know, I'm probably in bed by the time that things get
asleep in bed, yeah.
But I think, I mean, one of the things that's really great about being, you know, an academic researcher in Vegas, particularly with the types of interests that I have, is it really is like an ethnographic petri dish. You can kind mm-hmm. of look out your window and see all sorts of really interesting potential research opportunities or just things that are worth commenting on
right.
in general. And lots of people pass through Vegas. You know, the big adult entertainment expo comes to town every year. So there's a lot of different people who work in different facets of the adult
right.
industry
mm-hmm.
who are constantly coming through town. And then people who might not be as well known to maybe mainstream America also come through town. So there's a lot of really interesting activity related to kind of a sexualized economy or sexual commerce in and connected to Vegas.
Sex is a marketing tool primarily, and mm-hmm. not as a representative example mm-hmm. of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
You said something about that there's not a lot of conversation,
mm-hmm.
intelligent conversation about this topic in the city. Where in what forum would that occur? I mean, you've been
sure.
on panels at the AEE,
mm-hmm.
Cinekink, mm-hmm. the film festival was mm-hmm. in town.
Sure.
The first time for that, it's a very cutting edge out of New York film festival that did not well here.
Mm.
Are those the forums where people would seek out to have an actual intelligent, lengthy conversation about sexuality in Las Vegas? Where would that occur, and how would it occur? Would it be in the academic arena? Would it be one of these festivals? How would you engender that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think you know, there are places where you can go to have that engagement. I think that the CineKink is a really, really good example. I mean, I personally was extremely excited about that film festival coming to Vegas because Vegas seemed like just such an excellent venue to support a kinky film festival. And I was really surprised and somewhat dismayed that the local turnout was so abysmal. You know, we had people travel from Chicago and New York and Seattle, even a blogger from Norway. And then when I looked around the audience, there were several screenings where I could count, you know, the local attendees on one hand. And I was like, this is so interesting to me that here we are in Sin City, where there, on the one hand, appears to be a heightened level of engagement with sexuality. But when we actually get something with a little bit more depth that comes to town, no one came, or very few people came. I shouldn't say no one because there were locals, but very few people came. And that was kind of an eye-opener and a little bit of a turning point for me because, you know, I felt like that just kind of did make me think more about, to return to your question, where do people go for that engagement? And if it's not people coming to these things,
where can they plug in? Where can they make that happen? And I'm wondering if something like, if it wasn't just simply or at least in part a function, again, of marketing. Is this something the LVCVA would put on its website and say, come to Sin City and here's CineKink, and if you really want to get to the undercarriage of this topic, go here.
Yeah.
You know, go to this.
Well, I wondered.
Erotic Heritage Museum is where
I wondered
opening party
if,
was.
Some people perhaps shied away from the event because just having the title Kink, CineKink, may have felt intimidating to some people.
Not welcoming.
Or, you know, maybe they didn't know what that would mean. Maybe they felt like, is this just a festival of porn films? Is this just a festival of BDS films? And there was a range
of
representations.
I'm going to be poked and probed when I walk in the door.
Yeah, I mean, the film festival was great because it was such an interesting lineup of, you know, foreign films and feature-length films and documentary films and short films. I mean, it was like any other film festival, but the topic, you know, broadly speaking, was sexuality. But to go back to your question about where do people go? Do they go to, you know, a panel at UNLV? Do they tap into something like CineKink? Do they go to the Adult Entertainment Expo? I mean, those are certainly all viable options. I mean, there's certainly kind of panels and events at UNLV, and there are places, you know, in town where they can go to maybe have a deeper engagement. But I think, you know, one of the inspirations for kind of pitching this column idea was to hopefully create a little bit of a kind of public dialogue or discourse around some of the things related to sexuality, sexual culture, sexual commerce that are in fact happening in Vegas but often go underreported.
Right. Lynn Camilla is our guest this week. She's the Assistant Professor of Women's Studies at UNLV. Also, as we are going to be talking about now, a columnist who's going to appear monthly in Las Vegas Weekly. And your first column was about the Desiree Alliance Conference, which is by and for sex workers, only type of its kind in North America. And a lot of people, another misconception about Las Vegas and Clark County in a larger context is that that prostitution is legal here. A lot of people make that mistake.
It's a huge misconception.
Now, how would... where do you fall on that issue? I have a feeling that you are a proponent of these people being more mainstream. The people who work in this industry somehow being more mainstream, if it's legal or not, is that a fair representation?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, one of the big issues, perhaps the biggest issue, and I nod to this in the column that is out this week, is that people involved in the sex worker rights movement, you know, activists and their allies, a number of people are really in agreement that one of the biggest issues facing particularly prostitutes and escorts, is the issue of decriminalization.
Right.
That criminalizing prostitution ends up doing more harm than good. It drives.
You think it should be decriminalized everywhere?
There are different models that exist in different countries around the world, right?
Right.
And so here we have the legalized brothel system in Nevada, which exists in these rural counties.
Right.
But other countries, have moved towards decriminalization, and they still have some regulations in place. New Zealand, for example, is one such country. There's kind of legal and quasi-legal prostitution in, Singapore and Hong Kong and some other places. And, some of these kind of policies and laws are relatively new, so there's not a kind of breadth of research yet. But I think, one of the things that people might be thinking as they listen to this is, why study sexuality or why study these things?
Exactly.
Like, what does this have to offer as an academic enterprise or an intellectual enterprise?
What is the benefit to the greater whole if you're not unifocused on this?
Your interest. Talking about prostitution is, I think, a really good case in point that, in our country and, countries across the world, there are a lot of laws and policies in place that regulate sexuality in all kinds of ways, everything from zoning ordinances to, the criminalization of prostitution. Some people might be surprised to learn that there are a handful of states in the United States that in the 1970s and 80s expanded their obscenity clauses to include the sale of sex toys. So there are a handful of states in the United States where it is, in fact, illegal to sell vibrators and other quote-unquote obscene devices.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of kind of legal issues and policy issues that regulate and shape all kinds of, forms of sexual exchange and commerce that are often made without people really understanding those forms of commerce or those forms of exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
So what ends up happening is that policy decisions rely more on myths and misinformation than actual data.
And people don't decide, and our civic leaders don't make the decision to go to the Red Rooster to do research.
Right.
Or do anything, or to, to go into the, to step into, to visit. To,
right, so there might be
zones.
There might be zoning ordinances, for example, that regulate how the Red Rooster does business. I'm assuming there are. I don't know exactly precisely what those zoning ordinances are. But oftentimes what ends up happening is that concerned citizens kind of, launch a moral uprising. But their uprising is often based on misinformation or fear or, concerns with what's called secondary effects. If we have this business in our neighborhood, are crime rates going to go up? Are property values going to decrease? So on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this huge, prolific adult industry in the U.S., but when you come right down to it, there isn't a lot of rigorous academic research that really investigates the nuances of this industry, who works in this industry, who buys these different types of services, what are the kind of cultural meanings attached to these things.
And what could be the civic upshot? Also, I mean, there has to be an argument to counter the fear of crime, the fear of the property values going down, like living within two blocks of a place like the Green Door for or Red Rooster or whatever. And what's your answer to that? How can your community be enriched if these laws are relaxed?
Well, I think that that's a tough question. I mean, I would say that I think the community, let me back up for a second. I think the community can be greatly enriched with just more kind of factual information and knowledge.
Better education. Right.
And I think kind of tying this back to the Desiree Alliance for a moment, this idea that there's a conference by and for sex workers, which might surprise some people, but the whole idea in part is to give sex workers a sense of community and a sense of voice in a world where they're, hands down, and marginalized and very often silenced.
Right. And what you did in your column, in the lead column, your first, in the lead of your first column, is to humanize this, put a face on it, a woman named Amanda Brooks, who is here from Singapore, where you just visited. And to do it that way, is that the key to bring the individuals out front and put them in front of audiences?
I think that certainly helps. And one of the things that I didn't write about in my column is the degree to which conferences such as the Desiree Alliance Conference take very seriously the idea of inspiring new activists and training new leaders. Mm-hmm. So they want people who are sex workers themselves and who are involved in the sex worker rights community to have information about the issues, about policy, about laws, and to really be in a position where they can interface with legislators and interface with the people who make those decisions who might never have met a sex worker before, you know, who might be, you know, basing policy on what they've heard on Fox News, for example. There's this, you know, real urgent sense of not just humanizing the experience of sex workers, but really encouraging them to take information and knowledge that they have about their own experiences as sex workers and bring those literally to the table of policy debates,
Lynn, have you ever been approached by one of our elected officials in this, like a county commissioner, for example, or a councilman or woman to ask about this topic at all?
Well, I've certainly participated in some discussions with legislators and kind of on issues, you know, related to prostitution in Nevada. You know, this isn't my primary area of focus of my research. I mean, most of my research is on what's referred to as the women's market for sex toys and pornography.
Which
so I do a lot of research on feminist sex toy stores and sex toy manufacturers. And
you worked at one in your research, right?
When I was doing my dissertation research, exactly. I did field work for 6 months at a business called Babeland in New York City. So prostitution is not my primary area of interest, although I can certainly speak about it and, you know, both in terms of kind of academic research, what has been done, what kind of research might need to be done in the future, but also to bring issues to policy people. So I participated in some of those conversations to really... And there's a lot of education that needs to happen, you know, to bring legislators and government officials kind of to give them a kind of broader picture or perhaps more realistic picture of some of the experiences of women who work as sex workers.
Yeah. And I know that even though we're out of time for this particular show, I know that you have a lot to say about that, the retail industry as well, which is incredibly lucrative.
Yes.
For the women's market, which you've written about extensively. And you're writing every monthly now in Las Vegas Weekly. She's in this current issue, writing about the Desiree Alliance Conference and about the great Amanda Brooks. Very entertaining and informative column. Pick it up. And I'll just thank you again for coming down, Lynn.
It's always
a pleasure talking to you.
I feel
like we can go.
No.
We can do this a lot.
Yeah.
We can have you on many other times.
Okay. Thanks,
and,
John.
And for all of us at Our Metropolis, this is John Katzlamitis reminding you to stay tuned for Observations.
Thank you for joining us for Our Metropolis. Join us again next Tuesday at 6 p.m. for Our Metropolis.